You're listening to the Global Capital Podcast, proudly sponsored by KFW.
Hello and welcome to the Global Capital Podcast. I'm Ralph Sinclair. I'm the London Bureau Chief at Global Capital.
And I'm John Hay, Corporates, Markets and Sustainability Editor.
As ever, we've scoured the capital markets this week to bring you the most interesting stories. And in searching high and low, we've ended up looking higher than usual. Because this week, our reporters Gaia Fredafont and George Collard have been writing about the airlines and their plans to raise capital.
Yes, we've got a set of airlines that want to do IPOs coming up. These are pretty rare. It's a very risky and cyclical industry. But, you know, just at the moment with the recovery from COVID, there's a lot of interest to float on the stock market by airlines. And we also had an interesting bond issue by Air Baltic at a remarkably high yield.
Yeah, now speaking of, maybe not remarkably high yields, but reasonably high yields. It's been a big week this week for the most risky strata of debt that banks can issue. That's additional tier one capital. And that's a positive sign for issuers given the recent change in interest rate expectations across the market. In short, the general belief is that interest rates will be higher for longer. Bonds repriced to match those expectations. And with that settled and banks now out of blackout periods where they enter in the run-up to announcing their quarterly results, they've come back to the market with renewed brio this week. John, tell us a little bit about the action in the AT1 market this week.
Yeah, and one of the interesting things about it this week was, remarkably, this was a week sort of marred by holidays from the capital markets point of view. Holiday is a pain, and there were 2 days this week when action was difficult because of them, but we still had remarkably a day Tuesday with three additional tier one capital deals on the same day. Now, that according to Primary Market Monitor, which is our in-house sort of bond tracking database, that has never happened before. And so there's remarkable interest for this sort of high risk layer of debt of bank capital. We had Banco Santander and Erste Group doing deals simultaneously in euros and NatWest in dollars.
Right, that's right. And it's not just that they got done on the same day. It's that they really priced quite aggressively and achieved sort of remarkable things. The NatWest deal, for example, came with a coupon of 8 1/8%. That was 5/8% through where initial pricing had started out. And then Barclays came later in the week, didn't it, John? And it did a big deal in sterling that was priced really tightly compared to its outstandings.
Yes, the £1.25 billion perpetual bond with a non-call period of 6.5 years came with an 8.5% coupon. And bankers thought that had priced 20 basis points inside fair value, dictated by its outstanding AT1s. So that's a remarkably successful issue.
And the fund didn't stop there, did it? Because there was the first ever sustainable Sukuk AT1 out of Saudi Arabia.
Yes. This is a rather narrow category of first, because there've been green and social and even sustainability linked ones. But this is the first to have a sustainable use of proceeds. It's from Al Rajhi Bank in Saudi Arabia. So it was the first public sustainable additional tier one issue, a $1 billion perpetual non-call 5.5 year. And that came at 6 3/8%, which is 50 basis points tighter than initial guidance, although they did have to shrink the deal slightly.
Let's talk a bit about how issuers managed to get so much done in one day. Santander and Erste both ran tender offers alongside their new issues, didn't they? Can you explain a little bit about what they did and how that works?
Yes, so when an issuer wants to refinance debt and with additional tier one capital, of course, like hybrid capital in the corporate bond market, it's very much a sort of special kind of debt that has to be refinanced with its own kind. So you're very much looking at taking out one instrument from the market that's nearing its the end of its life and replacing it with a new one. And you can do that in a very sort of specific and linked way. as Santander and Erste did this week with tender offers, where they basically go into the market and offer to buy the old bonds at a sort of market determined price. And you know, investors have a free choice whether to take that. But it often works very well alongside a new issue, because the investors can sort of hand over the old one and get given the new paper. So they've got the investment is replaced for them, and they can often make a bit of profit on it, because the bank that's the issuer will pay them extra to surrender the old bonds. And in this case, both Santander and Erste were felt to have been pretty generous to investors with the amount they were willing to pay for the old debt.
Yeah, Santander bought back its old 81, which had a 4.75% coupon at par. Those bonds had been bid in the market at around 97.40 at the time. So that's a decent bid if you were holding those bonds. And of course, you then got to replace them with the new issue, which has a coupon of 7%.
Yeah.
And Santander in particular was singled out for its investor friendly behavior in this regard, which was also significant because it was one of those banks that chose not to call an 81 back in 2019 on the basis of the economics for itself.
Yeah, it's the 81 market, of course, is one where issuers sort of have to weigh up what works best for them with the sort of notion of investor friendliness, because they have this optionality built into them where the issuer can choose but does not have to call the bond after a fixed period. And this is to take away the fact that investors don't like perpetual bonds, which fundamentally additional tier one capital has to be perpetual. So the issuers can sort of steer a course between being kind of investor friendly and prioritizing their own economics. And you know, that's been particularly interesting course for banks in the last few years when interest rates have gone up massively, and so the cost of refinancing subordinated debt, including 81, has gone up hugely. And it's, you know, there have been times when we've written and talked about on this podcast about, you know, banks being in quite a difficult position as to, you know, whether they would call an old 81 and issue a new one when it's going to cost them a lot more. But now that the market is benign, so full of demand, issuers like Santander and Erste are finding it quite easy to sort of recover the old ones and issue new ones.
This is a particularly interesting part of the bond market, isn't it, John? Because, and it's, you know, that it's going gangbusters now is interesting. I mean, it was barely a year ago that people were throwing their hands up in despair and were sure that this meant that the demise of 81 Capital was nigh.
Yeah.
After Credit Suisse went out of business and its 81s were written down by the Swiss regulator. And in that instance, the Swiss regulator didn't actually do anything untoward. It did what was in the docs, but it was unusual because it rearranged the perceived capital hierarchy. Since then, obviously, we've had a lot of successful 81 issues. But how has the investor base changed since then?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. And our financial institutions team, Atanas Dinov and Sarah Ainsworth, who wrote the article with George Collard, explained that the Credit Suisse thing, which was only, you know, just over a year ago, it is really quite remarkable if you think about it. $17 billion of additional tier one capital, a big slice of the market, actually wiped out. It's not just like a corporate default where there could be some recovery. It was written off at a stroke of the regulator's pen. And it's a pretty big blow for any market. The market did shut for a few months, but it's rebounded since the sort of middle of last year. And the interesting thing is that it's a slightly different market now. One of the key audiences for it used to be private banks, which would buy a lot of the paper, and they sort of retreated. And now you're seeing asset managers come in and buying the bonds. Now, whether that's because simply the private banks were the ones that got their fingers burnt with Credit Suisse, and they've sort of gone off in a huff, and a new crowd have come in taking a fresh look at it, I'm not sure. But you know, bankers are saying that the market is sort of better established now, weirdly, you know, perhaps because people sort of understand the risks better. And, you know, we spoke to Richard Staff, who's the head of capital and term issuance at Standard Chartered back in March. And he told our reporters that the 81 asset class continues to evolve, and the involvement of asset managers as an investor base has helped broaden the market. So it's sort of, you know, in quite a good place qualitatively as well as quantitatively.
Yeah, well, there's certainly never a dull moment in the 81 market. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the growth of asset managers buying the product is something we've seen in other asset classes too, as rates have risen.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It could that as well, that simply just the yields are now sufficient for them to bother taking that risk.
Yeah, and hopefully they read the documentation this time around as well. Well, we spoke to Gaia Fredafont about some coming deals in the aviation industry that could set light to capital markets. Hello, Gaia. Welcome back to the Global Capital Podcast.
Hi, Ralph. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now, a number of airlines you've written this week are thought to want to list on stock exchanges this year. I guess taking part in the recovery in the IPO market, which has had a disastrous couple of years for volumes. Perhaps the most eye-catching of which will be from Etihad, which is one of the two flag carrier airlines from the United Arab Emirates, and it had some pretty good news this week that could spur an IPO perhaps imminently.
Thanks, Ralph. You're right. Etihad reported this week some record profits of about $3 billion for 2023, and you know, revenue increase of, I think, over 80% over the last year. And yeah, these results kind of come as Abu Dhabi's sovereign wealth fund, ADQ, is looking into listing Etihad via an IPO, which could raise, people are saying, north of $1 billion. And as you say, it's potentially the first of many to come.
So this is an airline that's very well known, that's successful, big, and owned by a rich government. There's quite a lot going for it. Do you think that that's going to... I mean, a banker's telling you that this is an IPO that could succeed.
Indeed, people are really optimistic about it, generally. It's in a really strategic place in the Middle East. You know, it connects Europe to Asia. It's a hub airline like Emirates and Qatar, which means that, as I say, they're moving people, you know, from Asia and the Indian subcontinent through to Europe and the east coast of the US, and then, of course, around the Gulf. And, you know, Emirates and Qatar are both powerful competitors who do the same thing, but who have different strategies. And one of the points that I found interesting was that the Emirates and Qatar are wide-bodied airplanes, where Etihad has far more narrow-bodied planes, which means that they have more frequency of flights. And so that's part of the strategy as well. But yes, overall, like, it's a very well-regarded IPO that bankers are very excited about and kind of want to be on, and are getting a lot of calls about, and, you know, expecting it to be kind of a highly wanted asset.
And what about the other airlines that are looking to list? Because it's not just Etihad, is it? There's a real range of listings set to come. And in fact, we've had one already this year.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, by February already, Kazakh's airline, Air Astana, completed a triple listing in Kazakhstan and in London. You know, this is airline adjacent, but Athens International Airport also raised about $700 million in February as well. Those have already been done, as you say. The next ones to come, apart from Etihad, there's another one in Saudi Arabia called Flynas. The Latvian carrier, what we'll talk about later, called Air Baltic, and then Spanish airline Volotea, who's been on the pipeline for a few years as well. And then there's potentially the IPO of Uzbekistan Airways, which is seeking for a window this year, maybe as well. So yeah, it's a range, but it's a lot. Yeah,
and I think you mentioned Virgin Australia too. Aren't they also looking to list?
Yeah, they are. Yeah,
yeah. So that really is a broad sweep. Now, what is it that's driving all of this sort of intention to float on the stock exchanges?
Yeah, it's a good question. I basically pick out three or four main things. The first, probably the most important, is the fact that 2023 was the first kind of quote-unquote uninterrupted year in terms of COVID, which means that for the first time since 2019, we have airlines being able to report full-year results off the back of a recovery and results that are effectively a bit more representative of the company's actual financial performance than they were in the height of COVID. So, for example, Etihad, of course, came out with good results on Monday, which we spoke about, and actually IAG, the group that owns British Airways, came out with some results on the first quarter today, which also reported a big improvement in performance year on year. The takeaway from that is basically that we are at a sweet spot in the cycle right now. And a number of airline businesses that have struggled through COVID are now, you know, we're genuinely seeing good profitability again. So investors, I think, can see that, yes, it's a cyclical sector, but equally, when you're in the right part of the cycle, these can be very interesting investments.
I think it should be emphasized, shouldn't it, that just how risky an industry this is. I mean, from a credit point of view, traditionally it's terrible. The nearly all the major airlines are junk rated, or have been. They tend to have high leverage because they need to either acquire or lease airplanes, which are expensive, and customers are incredibly price sensitive. It's very competitive. And you've got staff costs, which are difficult to manage, laid on top of cyclicality, which can mean that sort of big swings in actual use of the service. So, it's a tricky industry from an investment point of view. And clearly we're now benefiting from the upswing after COVID. People are going back to traveling. But, is there much further for that to run, do you think?
There is. I mean, that was only one point that I mentioned, but there are a few more. And you're right. Something that's so interesting about the airline industry is that really the success or failure of airline IPOs and related follow-ons isn't only dependent on, you know, the IPO market or specific airline, you know, macro conditions, but just like the worldly, you know, events like 9/11 and COVID hugely impact air travel. So it'll pretty much never stop being risky business. Like it's in the nature of the industry. And, you know, the IPOs, the health of airline IPOs, or more that, you know, the health of the IPO market can only go so far to help IPOs like Etihad and the rest of them. Because at the end of the day, the macro essentially defines how the IPO does and how the rest of its life will go. But yes, you're right. There is kind of more of a recovery to witness. You know, this isn't sector specific as a point, but it's a specific benefit to have to some of the airlines that are on the pipeline that are mid-caps, for example, that it doesn't hurt to have a constructive IPO market right now. So stock markets have become bull markets around the world, you know, volatility is at their lows. You know, the last dozen IPOs have traded up in Europe. And ultimately, the IPO market is working towards building out liquidity. And some bankers are saying that Europe has passed its first test in the IPO market, and the next phase is going to be about seeing if we have an IPO market that is accepting of mid-caps, which is actually the other ECM story of this week, which my editor Ian Gregory wrote. So it doesn't hurt at all that we're edging towards potentially a broadening out of the IPO market.
It's not just the fact that it's sort of mid-cap deals, but it's also the fact that these are riskier deals that make it the next sort of point along the IPO recovery trail, because these deals don't just attract the usual long-only investors, do they? There's a different crowd that show up in these deals.
Exactly. Hedge funds that kind of understand the sector very well, and I think there's definitely kind of no stigma associated with it as being a negative point, the fact that it's so cyclical. They would just want to look at the specifics of the business in terms of what their hedging strategy around oil is, for example. But effectively, the cyclicality point is taken into account by the multiples, really. So, you know, for example, if a company like a hospital is doing an IPO, you know, a hospital isn't cyclical. People get sick all the time is kind of the way I think about it. That business is going to be about 40 times price over earnings because there's no cyclicality in it. But you're not going to get that kind of multiple in an airline business because at some stage, the earnings, the E, is going to go down. So the fact that it's cyclical is something that investors and issuers are very well aware of. and the businesses trade at much lower multiples because of it. So, you know, these IPOs go well until that cyclicality kicks in, which investors, as you say, are not ignorant of when they first invest. So, yeah, there isn't kind of an underlying worry about the associated cyclicality, even though it's a risky industry, but the investors are kind of special investors that will want to just look at the specifics but are aware of those risks.
And in terms of the industry's recovery, there's an interesting wrinkle, isn't there? Because airlines might be experiencing a huge rebound in passenger numbers, but they also can't get hold of enough planes. I guess, you know, whether they're able to put up prices to compensate for that, I'm not so sure. But tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, you're right. So one of the most interesting points I heard this week was the fact that, you know, the demand for air travel is really high. The understanding is that after being cooped up for 2 years, people want to travel. And actually, almost no matter what, you know, they are much less price sensitive. But the reality is, though, is that there's a lack of supply of actual aircraft. And so, yes, while there's a lot of demand for leisure and corporate travel, the industry can't convert all of the demand. Which is good and bad, you know, it suggests that there's maybe more to go in the recovery. But you know, yeah, it's a function of, you know, recent safety delivery concerns from Boeing, for example, which actually a few weeks ago they admitted to perhaps not having completed all of their safety precautions that it needed to, which means that a lot of those planes have been grounded, and so the supply tightens and tightens and tightens.
I'm a bit skeptical about it, I have to say, because, you know, when people want to fly, they can fly pretty much, you know, and they might have to go a longer route. I think the thing that it could potentially delay is the creation of new routes, if airlines have got ideas for new routes, and they're waiting to get new planes from Airbus or Boeing before they do that. But don't forget that there's a lot of second-hand planes available. You know, there's a whole market in older planes that you can lease or buy. It's not like some other industries where, you know, supply really can constrain sales greatly, I think. But it's certainly an indication of that tightness in the supply market is certainly an indication of the strong demand surge in the industry.
Exactly. Actually, interestingly, UBS came out with an interesting report yesterday that tracked, I think it took like 7,000 responses to a survey that tracked intentions to travel this year, and it saw, you know, a slight increase in intentions, and so that's an interesting point. And yeah, it basically confirms what you say.
Now, you mentioned AirBaltic, Gaia. Our emerging market reporter George Collard spoke to them this week. In fact, spoke to the CEO. They're one of the airlines that you said were looking to do a listing. You know, often a company will sort of do something in the debt market ahead of a listing to, I guess, make it more appealing to equity investors. But what AirBaltic did this week was quite something, wasn't it, John? It was a bond that pays an absolutely alarmingly high coupon.
Yes, AirBaltic issued a 340 million euro 5-year bond at the remarkable interest rate of 14.5%, which is high even by the standards of emerging markets and the high yield bond market, which it belongs to both categories. The Latvian government, which owns 98% of AirBaltic at the moment, gave a backup order for a large chunk of the bond, about a third. It's not clear whether all of that order or even any of it was actually needed to get the bond sold. But the company had a specific amount of money it needed to raise, and it did raise it. And although, you know, other bankers around the city were somewhat startled to see a bond with such a high interest rate, and there was even some criticism, it worked for the company.
Yeah, just to put that deal in context, this is a 340 million euro deal, as you say, John. So it's not the biggest thing that ever printed in the emerging markets, but it's the second widest spread an issuer has paid or corporate issuer has paid. It came at 1,213 basis points over Bunds. Only a South African fashion retailer has paid a wider spread than that, and it was only 50 basis points wider, and that was back in 2013. And that 14.5% coupon is the highest ever for a corporate bond from Central and Eastern Europe in euros, and it's the second highest if you include dollar deals too. So really was something.
So why was AirBaltic wanting to do what some people might think as a suicidal bond?
Yes, well, Martin Gauss, the CEO of AirBaltic, who spoke to George this week, would not agree. I mean, he did acknowledge it's a high coupon, but he says that the company has plugged that interest rate into its long-term plan. So they believe they have the ability to pay it. Now, it's an annual coupon of 49.3 million euros. So it's quite a lot to find. But of course, the point is the bond is callable after 2 years. So perhaps they'll take a view at the time that they can refinance it for cheaper.
Well, the key point, isn't it, is that they're planning to do an IPO. And I think the idea will be that they'll refinance, they'll do the IPO and then be able to repay, you know, repay the bond. They also had a bond maturing. You know, they didn't have a lot of choice because they've got a bond that's coming up for maturity. So I think that's how the lead managers understood the deal and the spin they put on it was that, you know, this is essentially a bridge to the IPO. But it is interesting in the context of how volatile and unreliable we know the IPO market is. And, you know, so this AirBaltic of all those candidates you mentioned, Guy, is one that will really want to get its deal done.
Yeah, you're right, John. They are in an interesting position. You know, for them, it's not just the cyclicality that will, you know, that will impact them, but they are in an almost desperate position to recapitalize through an IPO, so much so that they have to pay, you know, a huge coupon on their debt. Geographically, you know, a war next door, in the words of AirBaltic CEO, puts them in a unique position than anyone else, really, and makes investors more wary.
Well, 14.5% on the bonds, who knows what on the IPOs, that's got to be of interest to the hedge funds at least.
So Gaia, airline IPOs are actually quite rare, aren't they? And obviously this is a sort of good moment for them, but you know, tell us just how rare these are and whether this is likely to continue.
Yes, I mean, it's part of the reason why I think this story is interesting is that there are like 7 or 8 in EMEA that are reported to be prepping for a listing on top of already the 2 aviation sector IPOs that have already priced. I thought it was pretty remarkable that, you know, after years of no or very little activity in the airline IPO space, you know, I think we've had 3 in the last 10 years. We think of Wizz Air in 2015 and then Norse and Norwegian 2021. That's 3 in like 9 years. Now it looks like, counting the 2 public listings that have already happened and the 7 or 8 that are circling around, of course, it's not like they're all going to get done maybe this year, but that's at least 10 in the aviation sector that have appeared, which is remarkable.
But if they're coming at the sort of peak of interest in the market and in the industry, does that recovery have much further to run?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's been a recovery from COVID. It's going well. The question now is it going to continue? And some analysts say that what the valuation suggests is that maybe not, and that it's kind of cause for concern. And, you know, they're kind of worried that they've kind of reached peak profits and there's potential for, you know, disappointment rather, if anything else. And effectively, they kind of think maybe from where we are in the next 12 months, it will look worse than it does now.
Yeah. So there's perhaps an idea for some of these airlines to get on and do it sooner rather than later.